Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with Stone Payton, another episode of Office Evolution Radio. And Stone, got quite a crowd today.
It's a packed house, man. We got a full studio. We got entourage. We got paparazzi. We got beverages and food. This is going to be a lot of fun. First up on this episode of Office Evolution Radio, please join me in welcoming to the broadcast Director of Product and Operations with Citizens Reserve, Mr. Martin Kaczynski. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon, Stone. Thanks for having me.
Well, Martin, before we get too far into things, can you share a little bit about Citizens? How are you serving folks?
Absolutely. We'd be happy to. We're a technology startup out of Silicon Valley, and our focus is on supply chain. And specifically, what we want to do is revolutionize the way that supply chain platforms and supply chain systems operate.
And then in what part of the supply chain do you work in?
So right now we're creating a supply chain platform that is industry agnostic. So it's very much a use case driven approach. So we'll partner with trading partners, technology partners, and then onboard specific use cases that are relevant for these users and customers.
And then what is the service you're providing them?
So the underlying platform is a supply chain as a service platform underpinned with peer-to-peer blockchain technology. And really what we're looking to do is provide a different way to integrate or to onboard onto a supply chain platform. So we're looking to change the way that organizations use supply chains.
So now walk me through an example of how this works.
Absolutely. So in a traditional supply chain, and some of our callers or some of our listeners may be familiar with some of the work they've done in the past, but in a traditional supply chain integration or system, what happens is an organization will work with one or two or maybe a small number of suppliers and integrate their point-to-point systems together. And what that does is it gives them visibility into that small subset of companies, but it doesn't give them access to a broader base of organizations. So what we're doing with blockchain technology and with our supply chain platform is allowing organizations to onboard onto an ecosystem. And once you onboard into this ecosystem, you also have access to all of the other organizations that have onboarded onto the ecosystem. So vastly expanding your network by virtue of participating in this platform.
So now say I'm a manufacturer. I manufacture stuff and I put it on trucks and they go to warehouses. So how am I going to leverage this?
One of the biggest benefits to blockchain in supply chain specifically is around track and trace and traceability of products, of goods, of raw materials. And what we want to enable is that additional level of trust and transparency into the products and goods that and consumers ultimately consume.
So now, but from a technology standpoint, what do I have to do something differently? Is something how does it going to practically work in my manufacturing plant?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lee. And I'd say that's there's no silver bullet, but data in is garbage in, garbage out, as they say. And one of the biggest challenges that we do have and that we're trying to solve is actually collecting that data. So in your example, as a manufacturer, if you have IoT devices or other technology, IoT-related technology that's collecting data across your supply chain or across your manufacturing processes, then what we can do is we can take that information, that data, make it accessible and available through blockchain technology and exposing it in a different way, meaning that it would be irrevocable data that you can then share with your partners or consumers.
But say I'm a manufacturer, I produce 1,000 widgets. So now I'm telling people there's 1,000 widgets available. So they can say, I want a widget, and then a truck can take 100 widgets, and everybody can see that transaction in a kind of a public way, but still secure?
Not exactly. I would think of it actually a little bit differently. By providing transparency, it's not necessarily transparency about the transactions that you're performing, because in a supply chain business or manufacturing business, that is going to be confidential information. So our platform does solve some of the privacy and confidentiality challenges that public blockchains have challenges with. What I would actually suggest is to shift that frame of mind to say that what we want to enable through our technology is the fact that the components that went into your widgets and being able to use the blockchain technology to demonstrate that, you know, the aluminum or the metal that went into creating those widgets was ethically sourced, or not necessarily ethically, but was came from a reputable supplier
overseas. So it's even prior to me. So like this would, like I guess a cleaner example would be like the diamond industry. So then you can see, okay, these diamonds came from a place that's sourced ethically.
Correct. That's definitely an example of that. Absolutely.
And then, so does this require a major shift in the way these businesses are going to have to do business?
I think so. And that's one of the things I love about what we're really, really doing here at Citizens Reserve. And we have a team of close to 40 staff, and we're really passionate about changing the way supply chains operate. And really it does change the mind, or shift the mind, or require a mind shift in how businesses operate, because what you're now suggesting is you're going to provide additional information. And rather than saying that your product is the best product, you can actually demonstrate and prove irrevocably through data that in fact your product does meet certain standards, or you have done certain tests, or it does come from where you think, or where you say it comes from.
So now what's your background? How'd you get involved in blockchain?
Yeah, it's an interesting journey. So I'm originally from Toronto. I moved down to the United States in 2012 with my family.
Originally from where?
From just outside of Toronto.
Toronto, okay.
Toronto, yeah. And I was in consulting and Big Four consulting prior to joining or moving into the startup space. And the current, so Citizens Reserve was actually my client. So I was managing the project, and I was there for about a month and a half, and was asked to join the team full time. So that was my how I jumped ship from the Monday through Thursday travel and long nights to less travel, but long nights in the startup space.
So now, did you always want to be an entrepreneur?
That's an interesting question. When I was in undergrad, I ran a window cleaning franchise business, which I learned a lot from. And I think everyone at one point or another aspires to be an entrepreneur and be part of a startup and to run a business. And it's certainly something that I think about every now and then, or thought about every now and then, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of that.
Was it a tough decision to switch from that kind of semi-secure corporate consulting gig to this kind of eat what you kill?
The
world.
You're absolutely right. And I think in the blockchain space in particular, one of the challenges is that there are a lot of not necessarily incumbents, but startups and organizations. And what we don't have in this industry or this sector are the platforms that have critical mass. Everyone is, you're trying to become the next Google or the next Amazon or the next Microsoft, so that you are the blockchain platform. And that's what we're striving for. But to answer your question, I knew I wasn't joining a couple of guys or gals in the basement or out of the garage.
Right. They didn't hand you a napkin with a great idea.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, just by virtue of engaging Deloitte a consulting company as a startup and being funded and having that seed funding already was certainly attractive. And but all of that aside, it's really hard to explain the team and the people that I work with day to day. And, we're small enough that it's really like a family, and we tell that to each other all the time. We care about each other. And that's something that I've never experienced, but that I was really attracted to. And I sold my wife on the idea rather quickly, although she was a little hesitant for the reasons that you mentioned.
Now, so from a culture standpoint, you like this kind of smaller team. You're all, you know each other, as opposed to a larger firm where people come and go. You may never even meet them in person.
You're absolutely right. And I think the other thing is that the shift in accountability is just really quite dramatic, because you need to be the instigator, the initiator. You need to make the change happen. And there's nobody to fall back on. You are the one that needs to move the needle on a regular basis, because if not, it's transparent to the entire team. And then, you know, people are going to start asking, what is it that you do?
And then is your whole team here in Alpharetta? Like, are you officing out of Office Evolution?
No, so we're actually based out of Silicon Valley. We have a team out there. We have the office here in Alpharetta. We have a couple of pop-up offices, in one in Naples, Florida, one in Miami. And then we have our development team in Bangalore, India.
And then so what is your role here in Georgia?
So as the director of operations, director of product and operations, my day-to-day is very much on product strategy, product roadmap. So really working with our technology team to make sure that we bridge the gap between what our business is looking for, what our customers are asking for from a feature set perspective.
And then how much time do you spend with the customer kind of diving into that?
Yeah, so for me, I would say that on a day-to-day basis, my focus is on defining the requirements. I would say maybe about 10% of my time is spent having conversations with trading partners, with technology partners, understanding some of their pain points, and capturing that and seeing how we can change that for them.
And then you're kind of the intermediary between the client and your developers, so they can build out the product or service that exactly matches what your customer needs.
Yep, absolutely, very much so. You know, I will take what I hear from our customers, and we have a 2-week agile project methodology that we implement, and I own that process as well. So definitely, what I hear from our trading partners and technology partners is something that I institute as part of our requirements.
So now, do you have an actual service that's being implemented right now, so that it's in use, it's in the wild?
Yeah, great question. I think that's the million dollar question. And I think when you talk a lot about blockchain and startups, a lot of them are based on a white paper. But how do you substantiate that? And so we do have a working MVP product. In fact, we showcased it for the first time at Market Waves 18, which is a supply chain and logistics conference that was held, I think, 2.5-3 weeks ago now in Dallas, Texas. And we're looking to launch our platform in Q1 of this upcoming year.
So you have beta users of the MVP?
Correct. We've currently implemented a computer part use case, so showing how blockchain can change the way that computer parts are procured on our platform.
And what do you need more of right now?
Great question, Lee, and I appreciate you asking. You know, what it comes down to is we have, when I think about our team and how our team is segmented and the different types of organizations or individuals that we engage, it really comes down to three types of individuals. One is from a trading partner perspective. If you know, there's a listener who believes that their supply chain is broken and they're looking for a different way to engage with a supply chain platform. So that's certainly one target audience. But at the same time, we recognize that in the platform that we're creating, we're not going to solve all of the supply chain problems or challenges. And that's why the way we're architecting the platform, we're going to be enabling technology companies to build or plug into our solution. So I'd say the second target audience would be technology organizations that want to offer their product or service through our platform. So let me give you an example. Warehouse management or fleet management, we're not going to be creating or recreating, you know, or ERP or SAP, you know, some of these big systems, but rather we want to provide connectors and an opportunity for our users to leverage those. And then lastly, as any startup you would expect, we're still doing a fundraise. So investors, if they're interested in learning more about the company, I'd be more than happy to put them in touch with someone on our team.
Now, where are you at from a fundraising standpoint? Did you're past angel, you have VC funding right now?
So we're past angel. We are currently speaking with VCs, correct.
For the first time?
For the first time.
exciting times. That's a business unto itself, right? That's separate.
Yeah, it is. And I'm lucky not to be a part of it. I mean, you can imagine, you know, in the blockchain space, things have really shifted a lot in the last year. The SEC is still looking to provide guidance from an accounting tax, you know, treatment perspective. And there's a lot of media out there that isn't necessarily positive about, you know, whether it's cryptocurrency or blockchain. And, you know, we have to navigate that and oftentimes dispel some of those messages.
And then maybe you can educate us a little bit about that. There's a difference. Cryptocurrency and blockchain aren't any, I mean, blockchain is different than cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency uses blockchain, but blockchain is an entity unto itself, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it any differently. I'm going to leave it at that, Lee.
Nicely done, Lee. So how does the whole sales and marketing thing work for a company like yours? Are you involved personally in the sales and marketing piece, or you got other folks? How does that work?
Yeah, so fair question. No, I'm not involved directly. What will happen is that I will participate in, you know, doing a demonstration of our platform to a trading partner or to a potential investor or a technology company, a potential user of the platform.
And then do you, you mentioned one trade show. Is that how you're going to go to market, is through trade shows primarily?
I wouldn't say that. I think the trade shows are a great opportunity for us to showcase to a larger audience what we're trying to accomplish. We also want to use trade shows to give us an opportunity to engage other technology organizations to say, we want to enable your technology on our platform. So it's a multi-pronged approach when it comes to trade shows. But I would say in terms of getting critical mass on our platform, it's going to be very much driven based on identifying potential trade partners through relationships, through advisors, and through just more broadly speaking marketing efforts.
And then you office here at Office Evolution, right?
That's correct.
And what made you do that? Close to your house?
You know, so yes, it is. And I was tasked with finding a location. And I will say, first and foremost, it's close to the highway. So that's convenient. Second is that it is close to Avalon, and Avalon is a great area up here in Northern Atlanta. And lastly, it's 4 miles from the house.
It's a good combination. And, if somebody wanted to learn more, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I think going to our website. We have some information about the project, about the team. Suku.world is our website. There's a
Suku.world, right?
Exactly. Thanks, Lee.
And then if they want to connect with you at Citizens Reserve, at LinkedIn, is that a good place to go?
Absolutely.
And that's probably good for you as well, right?
Indeed.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Pleasure.
Hey, keep up the good work, man, and let us know how it goes.
Yeah, I'm excited. If we do 10% of, so, you know, we're sometimes I feel like we're reaching too far, but if we do 10% of what we want to do, I think we're going to change how some people, you know, how businesses operate their supply chains and just how people get information about the products that they consume. So I'm excited about it.
Well, on the network, we do a show, and we have a channel just on supply chain, so maybe we'll connect you with those folks.
I think that would be great.
Yeah, we should get them connected with Scott Luton and that crowd with Supply Chain Now. But no, I can feel the enthusiasm. I can feel the authenticity. And if you're able to share that with the balance of the marketplace, you guys are going to do great, man.
I appreciate it.
Hey, stay with us. We're going to visit with some more folks, all right? All right. A lot more folks, as a matter of fact. Next up on this episode of Office Evolution Radio, please join me in welcoming to the program with Ram Biz Group Business Solutions business consultant Michael Horowitz. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon. Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, what'd you learn in that last segment, man? Or did you already know everything about blockchain?
Everything and then some. No, I have been reading it and looking at it, and clearly it's on the cusp of changing things dramatically.
So now in your world as a business broker, can you talk a little bit about what you do day to day?
Sure. On any given day, I am helping business owners to buy and sell businesses. We work with business owners who are perhaps looking to retire and sell their business, or a serial entrepreneur. He's taken the business as far as as he'd like, and it's ready to move on to the next venture and use the funding from the sale for that. We also work with people who are looking to buy businesses and acquire either for income purposes. Maybe they've had their corporate run, they've saved a little bit, and they'd like to put it toward an entity that they can own and operate. Also work with business owners who are looking to grow strategically and acquire businesses like theirs or complementary to theirs that will move the business to the next level.
So if you're getting at least thinking about the idea of exiting, mm-hmm. how soon should someone be having a conversation with you? Is it as much as a couple of years out, or can you cut it closer than that? What would you recommend?
Well, our last guest, I assure you that they've already got an exit strategy. So you want to form your exit strategy the day you start your business.
Interesting.
And, you know, most people don't do that. The vast majority of owners do not have a succession plan, do not have an exit strategy, haven't really even thought about the particulars and have certain notions running around in their head about what the business is worth, how easy or difficult it is to sell. But the reality is you need to be well prepared, and there are steps that need to be taken in order to get your business marketable.
Now, is this one of those things where it's better to reach out to you sooner than later when they have to sell it, or there's like some sense of urgency? Like, even though you may not get compensated until the end when the transaction occurs, you're willing to have conversations with people earlier on, right?
I am. And, you know, we can do some of that upfront consulting. What I'll generally do, depending on the circumstances that the owner and the business are in, is recommend an additional trusted advisor or two to help move that process along, build value in the business, get the blocking and tackling done that you need to have before you start listing the business and attracting buyers. So it often takes a team of trusted advisors, attorneys, accountants, finance folks, wealth advisors to get that business owner situated so that he and the business is ready to go.
Okay, I got to know this. What Lee's a business owner, mm-hmm. right? Major equity holder in this Business Radio X network.
Sure.
What are some of the kinds of more common mistakes that you see over and over that the Lees of the world tend to make?
Okay. So, unfun fact, 80% of businesses that are listed for sale, and these are small business and medium-sized businesses, don't sell.
Wow.
Yep.
Ouch.
Yes.
80%.
80% do not sell.
Well,
and it's not
hurts.
For lack of trying. Okay?
Right.
So the primary reason for that is the business is overpriced. It's priced wrong. They're trying to sell a $500,000 business in a $200,000 neighborhood. Not going to happen. So one of the most important things is to set expectations and realistic expectations to the owner of what that business is worth. Because buyers, savvy buyers, are armed with information. They know what it's worth, not only in their minds, but financially, they can look at the numbers. That's the biggest issue.
So are businesses only worth what the numbers say they are?
You know, there's the way we evaluate a business is we take a look at the financials. And one of the most important numbers we look at is net income. It's the net profit of the business. And then we'll take that and we'll add back things like your salary, the car that you're funding through the business, your cell phone. We'll add those back to a discretionary earnings number. Different businesses, retail, manufacturing, professional services, have different multipliers. We know what those multipliers are based on market comps, what other like businesses have sold for in the not-too-distant past.
Not in this equation is the emotional capital that I spent over the last 10 years building this puppy, right? I'd like it to be, but it's not, right?
The emotional component of this is high.
Right.
And fraught with the...
Everybody at this table is smiling because all of us have some sort of entrepreneurial bent to our work, whether we're part of a system or not. But and we've all paid prices that a lot of folks haven't paid. But you can't, it doesn't go into this equation.
No, that's your sweat equity. Sorry, you're not going to get it back. You've consumed your psychic income and whatever other income you've been able to get from the business. But at the bottom line, it's the bottom line. And people in the market space know what that reflects. So if you're a retailer, your store may be worth 1.5 times earnings.
Ouch.
If you're a manufacturer.
1.5 a year's worth of earnings.
Yes. If you're a manufacturer, 5, 6, 7 times earnings.
Okay.
So pick your business wisely and then make sure you really understand what its value is.
A number two man in a small media company, that should be worth a gazillion.
What's the multiplier on that?
He's not smiling.
Whatever you can get.
Well, I think that what's frustrating for business owners is they read these magazines and see these newspapers of these companies that don't make any money or don't show a profit and then are valued at billions of dollars.
Right. Completely different value proposition.
How do you get into that game?
Yeah,
you do what our previous guest does, is you get in early and often and you get stock options. And, you know, what's the figure? 8 out of 10 don't go anywhere, right?
Wow.
And
that
it's
hurts.
There's only one Amazon. There were a bunch of contenders. There's only one Google. There were a bunch of contenders. I'm old enough to remember who they were. I won't name them. But that's a completely different value proposition. We are looking at existing businesses. I want to see at least 3 years of financials, clean financials. And I'm not doing pro formas. I'm not doing expectations based on what I think the market's going to do. I'm looking at what they've done because the buyer is looking at what kind of cash can I get out of this business.
And you're looking at net. That, you're not impressed by the top line.
Nope.
You're looking at that bottom line.
That's correct. That's correct.
Now, is the anybody who buys something thinks they're going to get a deal, that they're going to make more money on it.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, absolutely.
So they want to see something that has room to grow, or
yes,
else they wouldn't want to buy it.
That's correct. And if a business has shown year-over-year growth, or at least managed to weather the cycles, there's a good reason to assume that that business is going to continue to do what it's doing. Like any prospectus, it's like past performance is no indicator of future. However, if owner A, if she's done a good job of running that company for 10 years and year over year the business has expanded, there's a reasonable expectation that owner B can come in and do the same thing, if not better.
But owner B is always going to think they're going to do better.
Always going to. And owner B always thinks the multiple is 1x, right? I'm going to get that business for a song, and I'm going to beat them up before we get to the table. So the seller is walking around with the myth, my business is worth 10x. The buyer's walking around with the myth, that business is only 1x. My job is to bring them together to reality.
All right, but somewhere in the middle of all that, earlier in the conversation, you talked about several different kinds of professional advisors.
Yes.
And I began, right or wrong, to paint a picture in my head of you sort of being the quarterback or the conductor of this orchestra. These are services we need to procure, expertise we need to tap to get our ducks in a row so that we can even be positioned to have the most advantageous conversation when it's time, yeah?
Absolutely. Your attorney may be a general attorney who's written a couple of letters on your behalf, but she may not be a transactional attorney who knows how to do deals. Your CPA may be a good CPA, but all he's really done for you is tax accounting. He's taken your numbers and put them into, and you know, whatever kind of entity you are, filed them accordingly. There are tax implications to selling a business, to buying a business.
Of course.
Right? and, you know, I don't know if you've ever been to a lender, but there's all sorts of money management that needs to happen here. On a personal level, this is probably a big chunk of your retirement. Once you realistically get an expectation of what the business might be sold for, is that enough? Or do you need to hang in there another 2 years and get a guy, a business coach or a financial advisor who can build the value, who can build the bottom line so that it's still 2X, but it's 2X a bigger bottom line?
So now how do you work with your clients in terms of that? Are you helping them grow it or are they, you just take it as it is? Like what are the conversations you're having with them?
Sure. I take it as it is. I'm interested in a business that's ready to sell, ready to go to market. Most businesses aren't. And that's where I do a lot of my listening. And that's where I have a network of advisors, valued advisors, who I can bring to the party to help them get to the point where a transaction is a reasonable consideration.
So now, what has been the biggest disconnect that a person thought the business was X, and you said, no, the business is Y?
Not a terribly big business, not a big disconnect, but I have an owner, for example, who he wants to retire and retire at when the business is worth $3 million. Today, the business is worth $1.5 million. He's got a gap to close, but he doesn't really know what it's going to take to close that gap. That's when I put him in touch with folks who can maybe get him to that $3 million level, valuation level.
Now, what are some of the kind of low-hanging fruit for businesses to increase their value?
There are a couple of things that, in that 80% number where a business doesn't sell, the price isn't right is the primary one, but very often the owner is the business.
Mm.
That doesn't sell real well. So one of the things that an owner needs to do if he's going to have a succession or an exit is to start to delegate and get the management in place who can run the business in his absence. If he can't go away for 2 to 4 weeks, that's a problem. Another thing that happens very often, and usually in the smaller end of the scale, but the books just aren't clean. And there's
so
a
that
line.
Means like maybe his credit card and the business's credit card are intermeshed or the bank's.
Which is fine. The reason we're in small business is to fund some of our activities in small business, right? But it's more that the accounting of it has not been clean and crisp, and you can't present a set of books. One of the things that a buyer is going to ask for during due diligence is this financial sheets.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any kind of lending that's going to be required, the bank is going to ask for those sheets. If they're not clean, if they don't look right, if they don't foot with the tax returns, well, there's a problem.
Because even if the buyer's fired up, he or she can't get the money from the lender.
That's correct. The lender will say, but, no, this is a non-deal.
Lee, I think our thing would hum like a sewing machine you for 2 to 4 weeks. But the financials, I don't know what kind of shape. I put the last couple trips on there.
Now, for you, when you're going to market, do you need more buyers or more sellers?
There's far more buyers than there are sellers.
Really?
Yes.
Dramatically more?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look how many, I call them corporate refugees, guys, gals in their mid to latter 50s, and that's the kind of time when corporations tend to shed you. And you've built your base of expertise, you've built some savings, you've built a network. Your question becomes, do I go look for another corporate gig? Or do I go find a business that's going to get me roughly the same set of six figures?
Don't they think that I'll just be a consultant back into my industry?
That's certainly a choice, right? But that is a strategy of you die at your desk, right? You work until you can't work no more. Whereas if you can buy something of substance that makes something, grow it, and then...
You can resell it.
That's correct.
So now... how do you get in front of these? How do you find these people, both sides of the table?
We I go to a lot of business expos. I talk to a lot of business owners, chambers, various networking opportunities. We do direct prospecting. And so opportunities like this to kind of get the word out that we are here to help help people buy and sell businesses.
So Rambiz Group, is that your firm or that's a larger entity?
It's a larger entity. We're a relative startup of folks who've been in this business for quite some time. And we're now four strong. We're looking to get to eight by the first quarter of next year. And
is it a franchise? Or?
It is not. There are franchise business brokerages and they do a nice job, but we are a small kind of boutique brokerage house.
But something drew you to join a group as opposed to just go out there and be the Horowitz show.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. What
sure.
You're thinking was
absolutely. Thank you. You know, I've got some experiences. I've got some core competencies. I, for example, have been with some Fortune 500 companies and had P&L responsibilities. I've owned my own bicycle shop for 7 years. So I've got a little bit of range of experiences. But certainly not enough. Now, Michael Ramotowski, who's the managing director of the firm, has been doing this for 30 years. He helped start up Century 21. He's got a deep understanding.
I've heard of him.
Yeah. He's got a deep
some
understanding.
Some of the other folks at the table have heard of him, too.
He's got a deep understanding of the franchise models. And a lot of, not a lot, but a significant amount of what we do is franchise resales.
Are the numbers better on that as far as do they typically have their books, the ducks in a row a little better? Do they have a better idea of value? Are they better prepared or not necessarily
so? No, because it's still, at the end of the day, it's an owner-operator.
Interesting. Yeah. I guess I would have thought they'd have tighter.
You know, I think depending on the franchisor, they ask for some reporting.
Right.
But, it's running the business.
As long as their check's clearing, they're okay.
That's
right.
Yep.
So now, if somebody is looking to buy a business, yes, what should they do? They contact you, and then what's kind of the process?
Depends on whether they are an income buyer, right? So that's the scenario where a person's looking to shift careers, shift jobs, get an income stream, own and operate and build a business. There are also strategic buyers who are looking to acquire businesses to complement theirs either vertically or horizontally. In the first case of the income buyer, they'll approach me and say, I want to buy a business. And then we go through the discussion, what you're looking for, how much money you got, what you want to do. And then we do a search based on their criteria of the type of businesses at the price points that they're looking for. If it's more of a strategic buyer, I'll sit down with the principal and any of his advisors and sit down and craft a criteria sheet that says what it is that they're looking for in the market space. And that's when I will get busy and contact owners and principals of those types of businesses and say, are you at all interested in an acquisition or a merger? And gauge their level of interest. If there's a level of interest, we'll start to talk about it.
But this has to be done very elegantly, right? Because you don't want to disrupt the business. You don't want all the employees freaking out.
Yeah, appreciate that question. Confidentiality is probably our most important value add that we bring. Nothing is done without signed non-disclosures. Mm-hmm. No information is exchanged until it's appropriate and timely. So thank you. Yes, that's a huge, huge area.
So now if a person wants to buy or sell a business, how can they get a hold of you?
Thank you. Well, there's our website at www.rambizgroup.com. And LinkedIn is a real good place to get a hold of me or my email. And I think that'll be published along with the show.
Sure. And that's Michael?
That's M. Horwitz, H-O-R-W-I-T-Z, at rambizgroup.com.
And then the in LinkedIn, it's Michael S. Horwitz.
Yes, all one big, long name word.
Good stuff. Well, thank you, Michael, for sharing your story.
Thank you, guys.
Hey, stay with us a little bit. We got a few more folks we're going to visit with, okay? All right. Next up on this episode of Office Evolution Radio, please join me in welcoming to the show Manager of Home Buyer Education and Counseling with Committed to Communities, Miss Tawny Powell. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me today.
Delighted to have you. I know you and I traded some emails over the last couple of days. I've been looking forward to you joining the show. And as I understand it, you got a crew with you, some other folks we're going to visit with as well. But before we do, tell us a little bit about your work, mission, purpose. What you out there trying to do for folks, Tawny?
Yeah, thank you. So Committed to Communities, our mission is really to reach renters across Metro Atlanta and help them become homeowners in whatever capacity that means. So a lot of our in-person outreach, we focus in Southwest Atlanta and outreach to low and middle income communities. We help them become homeowners and access down payment assistance funds to make it more affordable for those buyers that need it. And then broadly, we focus on educating folks across the metro area in how to buy a home and renovate it, or how to, start in an investment property, and just offering education and coaching and connecting them to powerful partners like the other two who are at the table to make sure that the process happens smoothly.
So how'd you get into this line of work?
Personally, I sort of accidentally fell into it. I was in the community development field doing outreach and youth education, and there was a job opportunity. I was fresh out of grad school, and the job opportunity was for homeownership work, and I said, I need a job, so let's go do that. And here I am 8 years later managing a nonprofit doing that work. It's been a blessing.
But it must be very rewarding.
Completely. I get emails and calls from people often, you know, saying, I never thought I would own my own home. I never thought I'd be here. And without you, I don't think I'd be able to do it. So it's heartwarming.
And then what are some of the challenges for that first time home buyer? What do they think maybe some of these obstacles that are insurmountable?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. I think a lot of homeowners don't realize the opportunities available for them, like down payment assistance or, you know, FHA loans and low percentage down payments of even conventional loans. I think there's a misconception that they need to have, you know, an 800 credit score or something crazy, or that they need to have, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars they would never have been able to save. And for the low and middle income buyer, we're able to help them get into homes for much less than they thought at first. So
now, when you're meeting with these people, are they coming to you because they have this dream, or are you coming to them to say, hey, you know, this is possible?
Probably a little bit of both. It depends on the route. Some people get referred to us when we have a lender who can't qualify them. Maybe they need some credit score work. They send them over to us, and I work with them long-term to get their credit score up. Some people cold call us with a dream, and sometimes I'm just in a space presenting to a neighborhood group or at an event, and somebody will say, like a young millennial will say, you know, I never thought about becoming a homeowner yet, but, you know, you look young, and if you can do it, like, maybe I can do it. Maybe there's something there for me. So,
now,
always.
If you're renting right now and paying what, $1,000 or $2,000 a month, you can be owning.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I also think people forget that there are some hidden costs of homeownership that we don't talk about, but you can definitely have a mortgage for less than $1,000, definitely less than $2,000 if that's what you choose.
And then when you're working with these people, are you helping them all? Like, what's the lowest credit score you've ever seen?
The lowest credit score I've ever seen close on a mortgage probably is about a 580. And that was years ago when there weren't as many mortgages being given. So I think maybe lending restrictions or the standard was a little lower. Today, I coach all my buyers to a minimum of a 640, higher if they can, just because that opens up more options for them.
And then what are some of the things you do to help them raise their score?
It's a lot of one-on-one coaching. It's also talking about budget. So a lot of times it's not so much that, you know, there's a ton of blemishes in their history, but it's that maybe their budget isn't as tight as it could be and they could afford to pay down some credit cards to get their score up. Sometimes it's also adding new accounts and people just don't have a lot of positive activity. So just we'll do refer them to things like self-lender or getting a secured loan or a secured credit card just to add new and positive activity to their credit report.
And then how quickly does that help?
It varies. It varies depending on every profile's different. Everyone's credit history is different. It depends on where their score is. So you can see significant results in as little as a couple of months. But if their history is long and not tending towards positive, it could take, you know, 6 months to possibly a year to get them where they need to be.
And then when it's at that point, then you can go and then you can do the deal.
Other things are to be considered. So I don't just coach on credit, but also budget, savings, and, you know, preparedness. So it would be how much savings do they have? What's their credit score look like? And also having a conversation about understanding the buying process. So when I turn them over to someone like Russell Elam, who's here, I want to make sure that they're educated and that I'm not sending Russell a buyer who doesn't know what they're talking about. So we have a conversation about what the process will look like and what to be prepared for. So they're ready when I pass them off.
So now you mentioned Russell Elam with Castle & Cook Mortgage. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, Lee.
And you also have with you, Will at the Harlan Realty Group. Will, you with us?
How you doing, Lee?
I know you got a lot of paper. There's a lot of things happening over there. Now, who is the mastermind behind this group to put this all together? Will, was that they're all pointing at you?
Well, yes, I was contacted by Chris in regards to the radio.
Okay.
Program.
So now you're the real estate person. Tawny is helping a person that to get ready to buy, and then Russell helps them get the mortgage.
That would be correct.
And is that a good team for you?
Absolutely. This is my team, or our team.
Our team. So now tell me about your work. How long you've been in this business? Is it primarily residential real estate?
I would say it's 90-10. But I do commercial also, and I work with investors, multifamily also. But I've been doing it to answer your question, almost 40 years.
40 years here in Atlanta or elsewhere?
No, here, 14 years here, and before that, Michigan.
So now what do you think of the Atlanta home buying market?
I think it's fantastic. You know, the normal slowdown now with the winter coming, Christmas and everything, people aren't thinking about buying houses very much, as much as they would be in the summer when they get their income tax checks back.
Now, what about, is it homes primarily or the big seller, or what about condos? I'm seeing a lot of condo buildings.
Most people would prefer to have, you know, when you're talking about younger people, they prefer to have a single family residence or a townhome. When people get older, they start thinking about condominiums and things like that because they don't want the upkeep responsibility.
Right. So are you bullish on both?
I'm bullish more on single family residences. Yes.
Are there parts of towns you like better than other?
We pretty much cover the greater Atlanta area, but our primary focus is in Gwinnett County.
Uh-huh. So you like the Gwinnett area, has a lot of opportunity?
Absolutely. You have a lot of people moving here. The school system is great. Prices are reasonable in the Gwinnett County. And it's about, 7, 8 zip codes in Gwinnett. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty diverse also as well.
And then in order for an area to be attractive, the school's important. But also the job opportunities, there's a lot of jobs in that region as well.
Absolutely, and there's a lot of growth, a lot of new people moving to Gwinnett County because of the school systems and the job opportunities.
Are you seeing people move from out of state into Atlanta, or do you think more people are moving here than moving away?
I think more people are moving here. Populations is on a steady increase, as you might note by traffic patterns.
Sure.
It's been growing for many, many, many years, and it's going to continue. Most of the Fortune 500 companies have some kind of headquarters here as well.
Now, do people call you from out of state and say, hey, I'm thinking of moving to Atlanta?
Absolutely. I get a lot of in-state buyers that just closed on one a few weeks ago from New York City.
And so they're migrating north to south. You see that a lot?
West to Atlanta. Even south to Atlanta from Florida.
Really?
And New Orleans and places like that
as
well. Is
it because of the jobs? That's the driver? They see a lot of jobs?
It's the jobs, and also this has gotten to be a kind of a hub for a lot of industry because of the location in the country.
Now, part of your job is to find the houses, but what do you do when it's time for them to buy? How do you kind of build this team of yours? Like, how'd you find Russell?
Well, actually, I'm the broker for the company, so I have about 7 agents. We're a small company, and most of the time I will give the leads for buyers and sellers out to the agents. I pretty much manage the business for the most part.
You manage the office.
Right.
But in order to do that, you had to build kind of a network of kind of your own group that helps the whole process through from start to finish, right?
Exactly.
So how'd you find Russell?
Russell and I met through a client, had a buyer that came to me, and she was already working with Russell, and I really liked the way that he handled and worked with his customers, and he was very good over the phone and very good at follow-up, and his processes were excellent, and so we began to do deals together, and I found over my preferred lenders, he's the best I have.
So that's part of the, you help the, a person comes to you, they want to buy a house, they don't know typically a mortgage broker, right?
That's absolutely true. Or they decide to go to their bank. Usually that's a more difficult process.
Why is that?
Banks are big, and so they can't, a lot of times, don't give the personal service that an individual mortgage company would do.
Now, Russell, for you, talk to me about your process. Is most of your business through referrals from real estate people?
Yeah, Lee, most of my business is through referrals, and it's been that way probably the last 15 years that I've been in this business. I've been doing it for a little over 18, and what I found by servicing realtors and referral partners, it makes my job a little bit easier where I'm not having to do a lot of the legwork going out and finding buyers or people that are looking to refinance, because I deal with buyers and people that are current homeowners.
Okay, so then they have less of a credit problems?
Well, it's not so much credit. It's more so that there's a lot of parts to completing a mortgage transaction, and it gets very difficult once you get to a certain amount of limit of people that you're dealing with all the follow-up and all the paperwork. So it's nice to work for a company that makes that process as quick and as efficient as possible in this industry, because I've worked for several over my 18-year career, and this is by far the quickest company as far as once you get the product, the paperwork into the company, they get it out same day or even next day.
Because you, you don't want any surprises, right? That's the worst thing.
Yeah, that is the worst thing. And that's why I call myself the mortgage pilot, Lee, because I try to design a picture to the client that I'm the pilot of your flight. And your flight is trying to land at the destination, which is the closing table. And sometimes the captain will tell you, hey, we're flying into some turbulence, so go ahead and strap your seatbelt on, right? And that's kind of what I try to make sure that if there's anything that could possibly come up, I know it beforehand. Now, of course, there are times the captain doesn't tell you, and it's the same way in the mortgage industry. You know, I ask you for a certain documentation, and that documentation provides something that would put you in a position where it may make it difficult for you to get a loan. You know, it's my job to figure out a way around that.
And then when you're helping them get the loan, is it one of these things where you want to get all that numbers figured out before they begin the home buying? Because once they fall in love with the house, now it's a different problem, right?
Definitely. We definitely want to get the person pre-qualified or pre-approved. And what I try to do with all my clients is get them pre-approved. And part of that process is, I like to mention that it's three components into purchasing a house. It's your credit, it's your income, and then the property itself. So what I do is I focus on the first two first for the pre-approval. Mm-hmm. So we pull your credit and we review it, make sure that it meets the minimum standard for any one program that we have. The second thing that I do is that I will then get your documentation, pay stubs, tax returns if you're self-employed, W-2s, all the normal things that pretty much all banks and lending institutions need, and I review it because there's a lot of online lenders out there that will issue pre-qualification, and they don't review those documents. And then that
kind of pre-qualified and pre-approved, they don't mean the same thing.
No, they do not. And that kind of goes into what you were saying with issues arising, because if you don't look at all the documentation up front and then you tell someone they're pre-approved and they go find the house and put a contract on it, and now they're going through the underwriting process, something could pop up because it wasn't reviewed at the very onset. So right. That's kind of what I do.
And then the tighter your systems are, that helps Will and his team, because then there's no surprise at the closing table.
Oh, most definitely. I think a lot of my referral partners really enjoy and respect that I give them a call every Tuesday to give them an update on the file. So everyone is on the same page, and I found that most of my referral partners love that.
Now, is it difficult in this industry where somebody like Will and his team, they can refer lots and lots of people to you, and it's hard for you to reciprocate back to them other than just do a good job?
Sure. It is difficult, but I found myself being one of the few loan officers in the metro Atlanta area that have buyers because I use different programs. There's a lot of down payment assistance programs that I'm the preferred lender. So the buyer comes to the program, and they come to me because I'm one of the preferred lenders.
So they're coming to you first before.
Exactly.
And then you can refer out to your preferred realtors.
Exactly. And that just tightens the relationship. And, mm-hmm. You know, the biggest key is that with those particular programs, you want the buyer to have the best experience possible. And when they're using someone that's been through it from the lending perspective as well as the realtor perspective or realtor perspective, then it makes it much smoother for them.
All right. Next up on the show, we got Cam, the realtor, and he is part of Will's team. Welcome, Cam.
Thank you, guys. I'm here with Harlan Realty Group, and I'm actually the realtor working with Harlan Realty Group now.
So is this your first job in real estate?
It is. Actually, my father is a architect, so I've been working with new construction for about 2 years now without having a real estate license, just kind of going over the new construction process, but now I kind of work with the sales, so I'm on that end now.
So now, how do you get people to choose you as their realtor?
Well, right now I usually do all the new inventory in the area. So, of course, you know, we have an inventory shortage in the market. So working with listings, usually it's easier because when you have the listing, you can market the house itself. But you can also offer the additional service to your buyers that are on the other end. So that's kind of how I've been working so far to get some of my clients.
And what's the difference between a realtor and a real estate agent?
Well, a realtor would be a member of the National Real Estate Association. It's kind of the same type of thing. It's just a membership in the actual organization that will make you a realtor.
Now, does that mean you're more qualified to do this? Or?
Well, not necessarily. I think that there are a lot of real estate agents who kind of work in sales and are able to get the deal closed efficiently. But I think if you're a realtor it's just a matter of being a part of the organization. So you have the very same qualifications, but, you know, your amount of service that you give to your clients is kind of, you know, dependent on the individual.
Now, I'm going to throw this question out to the group since you guys came in here as a group. Tell me about how some of these online tools are affecting your businesses. Is that something that people are bypassing you as individuals, or and they're just kind of going to an app or a website?
I think I'll kind of go first on that because I do have an opinion on that a little bit. I think that right now there's a lot of different applications that are working for buyers that are online looking for houses, but you still need a real estate agent to kind of orchestrate your actual transaction. And that's information that a lot of home buyers simply don't have, right? If you think about the last time you bought a house or how often you buy houses in your lifetime, it's maybe 1 to 3 times, you know, until you die. Right. So it's important to have a real estate agent with you, and with programs like Zillow or like Trulia or something like that, that's not really the same type of service that people are getting. So it's not really cutting the agent out as much as people would think, but it's definitely changing the way that people go about finding inventory.
Well, like Jeff Bezos says, your margin is my opportunity. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, there's, what is it, 6% is the...
Mm-hmm. That's usually kind of across the board, just kind of 6%.
So then, if some of these online places can start chopping into that...
Perhaps it's definitely possible, because I know with different programs, you can show as the listing agent or you could show as the person that's can represent the area. So sometimes that could be something that's a challenge, but I don't think it's something that's, you know, sometimes it does happen though. People working both sides of the deal. So we try to stay away from that because, you know, it's always a conflict of interest when you're representing both the buyer and the seller in your right. transaction.
Now, Russell, for you, you know, I can go online and put in some numbers and get a theoretical loan, right?
Yeah, I've seen it, I've heard it, but and here's the only issue I have with that is that it loses the human interaction piece and the eyeball test, if you will, because what I've found out and through my long career is that I've had a lot of clients that end up coming to me because they were turned down once the file went into underwriting by the online lender, because they're only looking at the basic figures and the basic numbers, such as your credit score and that, you know, whatever's on your credit report. They're not looking at your actual documentation. They're not really checking your debt-to-income ratio. That's all left up for someone like me with my financial calculator and things like that, where right. you don't know really how to work those figures and numbers while you're looking at everything online.
All right. And now another topic I'd like to talk about are millennials. It seems like a lot of them are renting because they prefer the flexibility to be able to move at a moment's notice. If a new opportunity comes up, they're less interested in planting roots, where a lot of people are afraid they might get stuck in a home. Maybe they had parents that they lived through where their parents, you know, kind of went backwards with real estate. How do you kind of serve that market?
Well, I think that with that particular market, being here in Atlanta, it's just a little bit different because it's such a vibrant market. There are so many people moving here. What I've found is millennials are looking to purchase because they're finding out, as Tawny mentioned earlier, that what they're paying in rent, they can actually own. And that ownership turns into a large financial asset over time, and that helps them, you know, look towards their future. So it's definitely something that they're looking at more in this particular city.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think, too, that with millennials, they currently make up about 34% of the home buyers market kind of across the country. So it's they're looking for different homes that they're able to move into. But I think an affordability issue is kind of rearing its head. When you think about things like student loan debt, it's kind of reached that trillion point now.
That starts becoming real yeah. money, right, when it's a trillion.
Right. So it starts becoming certainly something that's concerning. Of course, there are programs now that kind of discount student loan debt and the debt-to-income ratios, but that's definitely something that's starting to change the type of housing situation millennials are having. And that's just kind of something that will take time to kind of see the type of maybe we need some more, you know, financing instruments or just something like that will kind of assist and trying to get more millennials into homes, because there is still an inventory shortage. But, you know, the more people that move into the home buying market, the better for that type of situation.
Now, what parts of town are you most bullish on in Atlanta?
Well, right now I'm mostly in East Atlanta and the South regions of Atlanta, also a little bit the Western in-town markets. I really like the down payment assisted programs that there's been out there with like Invest Atlanta and a few different, you know, 100% financing programs that are working a lot for those rehabs. So I've been kind of using that space to kind of do most of my deals in.
Now, are you seeing a lot of kind of the flipping going on that mm-hmm. had been going on previously?
I am seeing it in certain types of markets. I think that it's something that's kind of been an answer to the inventory shortage and new construction. So people have been using those areas in town that have housing that's available, but it's just not necessarily up to date. So when they're able to do those flips in those areas, you can attract different home buyers into the in-town markets. It's also convenient using, you know, the transportation systems. You have those job opportunities that are closer to the downtown area. So that's kind of why I've been in the in-town market. And the flipping that has been going on has been able to provide the housing that's kind of attractive for people to move into.
Now, what about outside investors? Are you seeing like people from other countries mm-hmm. and other areas buying and flipping houses in town?
Right. I am kind of seeing that. I do work with investors and in the private equity space a bit. And I have been seeing a lot more of an international presence of investing in real estate overall. And I think that when we go to different markets across the country, Atlanta is really attractive on an international scale. And it's also something that's affordable for people to move into for an investment. So I think that that's why Atlanta has been the bigger, you know, area for the flip. So the areas like Nashville and, you know, Pittsburgh, I think a few people have been showing interest in places like Indianapolis in the Midwest for those rental markets there. So it's definitely been something that's interesting for those international investors.
And then you're bullish in Atlanta as well.
Yeah, I'm definitely bullish in Atlanta just because I think Atlanta has a wonderful job market here. There's a lot of different industries that have come to Atlanta that have kind of called Atlanta home for, you know, the latter part of 2014 and 15. So now that they're here, you know, they're up and running, I think other companies are starting to come in and, you know, kind of take heed to show, you know, this is a good area to move into. Along with housing prices, I think that a lot of, you know, opportunities come out of moving here entrepreneurially and from a corporate perspective.
So now if somebody's moving to town, what you're sending them in town?
I am sending them in town just because those programs that are in town are in the city limits. Those are usually the better programs that I'm seeing for the down payment assistance programs. And I really like the Eastlake Golf Course area and those parts of East Atlanta because it offers good affordable housing, but it also offers a nice environment for them to live in. There's a lot of schools that are available. There's a, you know, we have the charter school system that's available in the inner city of Atlanta. And you also have a lot of those commercial spaces that people can kind of take advantage of while living close to all of the things that are in the area.
Now, what about the gentrification of some of these areas?
What do you mean by that? Like
the pros and cons of that.
I guess you would have to see it as, again, creating that in-town inventory, right? If there are areas that do have housing available, but it's just kind of maybe we want a new type of paint on the house or something like that, or we want some updated electric appliances, like those type of things. Definitely people are using loan programs like the 203K program that's available to kind of get comfortable in those in-town markets. So I think that that's kind of where the gentrification conversation may be, you know, kind of attesting to.
Well, I was talking about like along the Beltline. The initial purpose of the Beltline was to have people of all different income levels benefit from the Beltline. And then it comes in and then all of a sudden all those houses are getting taken out. And now they're all $500,000, $600,000, $1 million houses on things that should have been was originally intended for any income.
Right. Okay. So I think, too, with the Beltline, the biggest thing was the accessibility. It was to make sure that different neighborhoods in the...
So it's working in that regard.
Yeah. So it's definitely,
accessible,
you know,
and people like to go on it,
yes,
and people are enjoying it.
Yeah.
But it's not for everybody anymore.
Right. I think that that's something that kind of comes with just the changing markets. You know, when that type of, you know, project does come to somewhere like Atlanta, it's such a large project. It goes into different types of markets in the inner city areas. So I think that people can utilize it at all income levels, but it's just a matter of how close you can get to it, you know, and that kind of, you know, creates that.
Speaking on the gentrification issue, that is a problem. That's something that's going on throughout the country. And
so you see that as a problem?
I see that it can be a problem if it's not done the right way, and a lot of times it's not done the right way. For example, if you're going to displace people that are already there or not give them the proper values for their property, what's going to end up happening is the people are going to buy the properties at a higher value, and then if we have a market crash, or those people are going to end up getting stuck at They're going to be upside down. So you have to watch and balance that out.
History may not repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It does. It does. That's what has happened before. So,
right.
So we have to watch that in terms of pricing. I think the better formula is to make the pricing affordable for middle-income people. I think that's a better approach.
And then that's why you're kind of more bullish in Gwinnett?
That's not why I'm bullish in Gwinnett. I'm bullish in Gwinnett mostly because I live in Gwinnett. And as you know,
that's
in Atlanta,
to
go 15 minutes can take you an hour, depending on traffic. So, but I like Gwinnett because of the diversity. I like the school system. You have all of the ethnicities, age ranges, everything in Gwinnett, and I really like that about Gwinnett.
And then, but your team serves all of Metro Atlanta.
Yes, absolutely. You have people in Cobb County. Mm-hmm. We have people in Douglas County, Atlanta, et cetera.
All right. And if somebody wanted to learn more about you and your firm, what's the website?
The Harlan Realty Group Atlanta.com.
And that's Harlan, H-A-R-L-A-N.
L-A-N. That's correct.
Realty Group Atlanta.com.
That's correct.
And that's the way to get to hold of you, Cam, as well?
Yeah, I'll be on the website as well, but my LinkedIn is a little bit better. So
all
just
right.
Cameron Bain will be good if you can contact me directly.
Cameron Bain, B-A-I-N.
Yes, sir.
All right. And then Russell?
Yep. My web address is www.themortgagepilot.com.
Themortgagepilot.com. And you're part of Castle & Cook Mortgage is the firm that you work with?
Yep. I'm one of the branch managers out of the Kennesaw office.
And then, Tawny, the best way to get a hold of you?
Our website is www.committedtocommunities.com. Our info is on there, and people can sign up for a one-on-one appointment with
me
right there.
And then, Tawny, a person who would be good for you would be somebody that's kind of dreamed of owning a home and maybe thought it was impossible but wanted just to learn more?
Yeah, anyone who wants to buy a home and doesn't really know where to begin, I'm a good first step.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you.
All right, and thanks to all our guests today for sharing their story. This is Lee Cantor for Stone Paint, and we will see you all next time on Office Evolution Radio.